From the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, this is The Televisionaries. Hello! Today we're bowling a maiden over, staying in a lot more than we plan to, and we're pulling up short on a 100-metre track. I'm Louise Rugendyke, and welcome to The Televisionaries. Just a warning that this week's audio is a bit wobbly because we're all social distancing and I'm recording this under a doona attached to a clothes horse on my dinner table. But here we go. So here with me today are my fellow self-isolating colleagues from the Herald and the Age newsrooms. We have the editor of The Guide and Green Guide, Paul Colina, and calling in from our LA studio is our culture editor at large, Michael Adato. Hello.
Hello, hello.
Hi, Louise.
Gents, right. You okay? You're not too isolated? You're feeling fine?
No, feeling good.
Yes, yes, so far. Day one
in lockdown. All right, look, today we're opening with The Test, a new era for Australia's team. It is Amazon Prime's glossy 8-part documentary about the Australian men's cricket team. It sells itself as a behind-the-scenes look at the team's efforts to rebuild themselves after the ball tampering scandal in March 2018 that saw captain Steve Smith, batsman David Warner and bowler Cameron Bancroft all suspended for colluding to rough up a ball with sandpaper. But this is a story of what happened after that, with the appointment of a new coach in Justin Langer, a new captain in Tim Payne, and a total overhaul of team culture as they spent 18 months working their way back into the public's good graces and attempting to reclaim the Ashes. Amazon are promoting this series as part of their efforts to boost Australian content, but it is also co-produced by CA Films, which is part of Cricket Australia. Let's listen to a clip before we start talking about it. This clip is from the trailer, and I think it sets the tone up nicely for the show.
Some tests last 5 days. Theirs lasted 2 years. Reputation broken. Character questioned. All eyes were on them, waiting for them to slip.
That is pressure.
When the weight of the nation meets the eyes of the world, you either toughen up or tough it out.
Hardly watch. Done it.
You've got a nice gravelly voice to talk about this, Michael. That's the theme of it.
I do. Look, what was that? It's funny. Trailers are always such odd things in a way to listen to. That narration sounded like Martin D'Estasio from Frontline. although there is a conversation to be had here about kind of the poseur of it, the posiness of it all. In a way that talks to that. That narration was sort of so kind of overbaked. I really enjoyed this, I've got to say. It's incredibly polished. It's really interesting. And I say this as somebody who doesn't really watch cricket or indeed a huge amount of sport outside of tennis. The important thing to remember here is, of course, sports documentary is not sport. It's a very different thing. And in fact, it is documentary. I think it's a very beautifully assembled documentary. It is maybe a little too polished, and there are probably too many kind of theatrical moments and clever fades and glances into the kind of, the nearby distant, kind of field of vision, which kind of just, that's where you really, I think, you start battling with the authenticity of what you're watching. Because as you rightly point out, this is produced by cricket's kind of governing body. So it's challenging in that way. I think that you do watch it with it. It's engaging and it's illuminating, but it is also, it's not that it's distracting, but there is something about it. It just looks a little too polished and a little too packaged.
Yeah, that was my thought going all the way through it. Was this a documentary or is it propaganda? Because it's a little bit of both. It's a very much a rebranding of the Australian team because, let's face it, when the ball tampering happened, the backlash was enormous. So this is a real remaking of a team. And that kind of sat a little uneasy with me in parts. I was very much enjoying it. I'm a big cricket fan. I loved it from that perspective. But there were points where I was thinking, I want the questioning a little bit deeper. I really want to know how Tim Payne felt to be given the captaincy, almost to be betrayed by his teammates. And they don't really go into that. Paul, what do you think?
Look, we only have the Adrian Brown who made it. We have his word that the Cricket Australia did not interfere in any way in the making of the show. And one of the things that he said was that you know, there was no script. There was absolutely, I mean, when he went into it, he had no way of knowing what was going to pan out, whether they would be triumphant or not, any of those things. One of the things, I mean, it's interesting that Michael used the word overbaked before, because, but one of the things that I really liked about, and I loved the documentary, I found it really, I think it's beautifully put together. I mean, I found parts of it incredibly exciting and also very emotional. I mean, that the sequence in it where the players are given their baggy green, I mean, that was just beautiful. But one of the things that I really liked about it is that I'm so used to watching documentaries these days that have kind of taken that 60 minutes thing to such a ridiculous extreme where, you know, the reporter as, you know, superstar, as the reporter, as the person who's going to solve, you know, what's going on, and and the use of music. I mean, so much of what we watch, and even, you know, the sort of blue chip ABC documentaries lately have fallen into this trap. They're kind of so portentous, and they're so obvious and heavy-handed in what they're going to say. That's one of the things that I really loved about this, because it still has a narrator. I mean, it still has music. It still has a lot of those stylistic things in them. But I never felt that I was going to be slapped over the head with what's coming next, or with the narrator's idea of, you know, where it's headed.
Yeah, let the actual talent speak for once.
Mm. And letting the story unfold. And I think that's one of the beautiful things about this. That's why I really like reading that comment from Adrian Brown, where he said he didn't know how the story was going to pan out. Because sitting there watching it, I got that sense too, that it could have gone anyway. It was kind of predictable.
If Australia hadn't won the Ashes, would Amazon have bought this? I mean, are you going to buy an 8-part documentary without the fairy tale ending?
Of course.
But they committed to it before. I mean, at the time they committed to it, they had no idea whether they would rise from the ashes or not. And actually, to come back to that too, it's interesting because Amazon, there's actually quite a few documentaries that Amazon has commissioned in this sporting field, and they're very, very similar. And they're these long, multi-part documentaries that kind of fly on the wall inside a particular sport. And there's a really, really good one that they've done on the Manchester City Football Club, which is terrific. It's very similar to this, I mean, albeit it's about Premier League. But it's interesting that you know, Amazon is getting into this field.
It's a point of difference to Netflix, I suppose, or, you know, their other sort of big competitor. I mean, what's he saying, you know, it's the same before about letting the talent speak. That was the one thing I really appreciated about it, is it was actually hearing the players talk about the game in the sort of non-soundbite manner. Like, you know, we're so used to hearing sportsmen and reading sportsmen having these really rote quotes all the time. This was actually letting them talk a little bit more in depth. But I also was missing, I do still think it was missing a little bit more of the personal stories. It was very much an on-field documentary. Mm. Like, there was a couple of times at the end, sure, showed Matt Wade saying that, you know, he left his four-day-old daughter to go and play the Ashes. But I wanted a bit more of that. Yes, they cried over getting their baggy greens, but, you know, they talk about sacrifice, about leaving their families, but what does that actually mean? I just said I loved it, but in the end it just left me wanting a little bit more. But that said, I was very happy to see Pat Cummins given a large role in it, because he's possibly the most handsome person in Australian sport, but by the by.
Yeah, no, I guess that might be one of the, you know, one of the things is that it doesn't travel. I mean, it would have been a bit outside of the scope of this documentary if it had too contrivedly gone outside of that setting to talk to the families of, for instance, you know.
I don't know if I necessarily just wanted the families. I just wanted a sense from them maybe that something beyond just cricket.
Hmm.
I just wanted a little bit more emotion. I was thinking, it's the other thing I'm watching at the moment, of course, is Cheer, the Netflix documentary, where they're, you know, these little stories about these sort of college kids and the hard backgrounds a lot of them come from. And that shows what's really pushing them towards the top. And maybe I didn't quite get that from this. What is pushing, you know, these men to leave their families behind for long stretches of time? And it can't just all be about winning a trophy. Yeah. I mean, maybe it is, but what's driving them a little bit?
Yeah.
Well, Michael, is there anyone you'd like to see a documentary, sporting TV documentary made on? I know you're a big tennis fan, so who would you like to see next? Roger Federer? I would.
Maybe, but I'm not convinced.
I mean, the truth of modern sport is that it's so marketed and it's so packaged that I think you're always, if you don't, even if you don't have Cricket Australia bankrolling you or kind of having their name down as a co-producer, you're going to have something's going to be in there. There are too many layers of control, and I'm not sure that you see anything terribly authentic in the end result. I think it's a struggle to find that authenticity. I think that there are certain things that work in that way, like documentaries about things like the Fyre Festival, because what you're watching is this kind of broken structure. It's kind of all, it all unravels in front of you. But I think the truth of modern sport is Roger Federer's people are never going to let a camera in the room when something terrible is happening. So you're never really ever going to get anything other than the heavily marketed, heavily brand endorsed package. And in that sense, I don't know that anyone's going to make one that's going to be honest or that isn't kind of brand friendly.
Mm.
That's where I think it gets tricky.
Well, maybe we won't ever get to really see the real truth of our sports. But look, I still enjoyed the test. I'll watch it again, actually. Quite liked it. Anyway, let's jump on to our game time. This is our little game for the week. We've left behind 6 degrees of Ben Mendelsohn for last week. So this week we are doing Who Am I? Michael, Paul, are you ready?
I'm ready.
As ready as I can be.
I was born on April 7, 1964. My mother, Jocelyn, and my father, John, both worked in the film business as caterers. When I was 4 years old, we relocated to Sydney from abroad. Any ideas?
No, not at this point.
I'm going to take a stab. Michael Hutchins?
I'm not telling until we get to the end, Paul. Ooh. Have a think about it. No Googling. I'll give you another hint at the end of the show as we're wrapping things up. It's safe to say we're all spending more time at home at the moment, and while we don't want to make light of it, a nationwide shutdown is a pretty good opportunity to catch up on TV while you're, quote-unquote, working from home. However, with 6 major paid subscription services to choose from, how do you get the most bang for your buck? Netflix charges $9.99 a month, and they've just stopped their 30-day free trial, so you've got to pay if you want to watch. Stan starts at $10 a month with a free 30-day trial. Amazon Prime is $6.99 a month with a 30-day free trial. Apple Plus TV is $7.99 a month with 7 days free, while Disney Plus is $8.99 a month plus a 7-day free trial. And then Foxtel, you can stream from about $25 a month, but for the full service, it starts at $59 a month. So that's not to mention the free catch-up services such as iView and SBS On Demand, plus a scattering of smaller streamers. Basically, there are more channels than there are dodgy rom-coms on Netflix. Paul, what would you choose and why?
I mean, if I was only going to choose one paid streaming service, I would pick Stan. And I think that's because they have a lot of... I think the interesting thing with the streaming services is that, you know, when they first came in, you might have subscribed to Netflix because they had a particular show, you know, that you wanted to watch. And I think what's happened over the years, though, is that we've now begun to look at them more as libraries. And it's almost like the buzzy new show is just the icing on the top, but you're actually paying for that depth of content that they have. And that's why I'm more interested in Stan, because I think they have a much, much more interesting kind of curated back catalogue. They've got a lot of BBC content on there. They've got a lot of the Showtime material. And, I wonder if that has changed, you know, that we're no longer driven to a service just because of the new show, but because of this large library they have. I mean, for that matter, SBS On Demand, if you don't want to pay for something, I mean, what a killer collection. I mean, the amount of content out there is phenomenal. It is, of course, free. It's ad-supported. That means that you have to put up with 3 or 4 ad breaks every hour. It's about what the sort of the depth of the collection, the depth of the library is the biggest hook, I think, these days.
So it's Stan for you. I suppose we should say at this point that Stan is owned by Nine, who owns this podcast. Michael, do you have a pick? What would you choose and why?
Look, it is a tricky call. I mean, I've kind of always had a thing that I was called the iceberg theory, which is sort of a, it's like a scientific version of exactly what Paul just said, which is that streaming services kind of come at you like an iceberg. There's a bit above the water that you can see, which are the commissioned originals, and there's a big fat berg under the water that is the library of kind of old stuff, you know, kind of classic series, whatever. Netflix is a really interesting iceberg because it has a really, really, probably has the strongest above the water point of any of the services because it's got so many original programs that it's commissioned. At the same time, it kind of has a reasonably poor below the line library. Paul's right when he says Stan has a better library. I feel like Foxtel has a better library. And if you are a kid, Disney Plus has a better library. The other interesting play into that is that Amazon and Apple don't just have their content. They are resellers. So there's, you kind of have a window into other content that you can buy on a kind of per movie or per show kind of basis. So they're both attractive in that respect. On the free-to-air side, you have obviously a bunch of free services, and also in America we have a thing called FilmRise and another service called Tubi. Tubi has launched in Australia, and essentially it's ad-supported. It's a really fat library of ad-supported content of movies and TV shows and kind of a whole bunch of stuff. So there's a sort of – there is this sort of second wave streamer, which is that the ad-supported streamer that is kind of, you know, jumping that line, because they're coming into an economy where it's driven by subscription fees. And I think they know there is something terribly attractive to a consumer about – paying nothing. And the reality is we've all grown up with free-to-air TV. So I think for those of us maybe who are over the age of 20 or who aren't YouTube generation kids, we're accustomed to seeing ad-loaded TV content. So it doesn't really bother us that much. I was interested to hear that Netflix in Australia has closed its free window. In America, it's expanded it from 7 days to 30, precisely because of the shutdown and because people are indoors. Yeah, so, I mean, the LA Times recently did a really interesting piece, which is sort of like navigating all of the 7 day and 30 day free windows to basically, can you build, and they very successfully built, a schedule of streaming content that you could watch all the way through for a couple of months with paying nothing, with kind of signing up and disappearing before the free window had closed. It's really a hard call for me. I feel like Foxtel probably would be my choice, and I say that only because they're a reseller of some content. They have a big fat chunky library that's the rival of anyone else's big fat chunky library. What I think I'd miss are things like The Mandalorian on Disney Plus, or kind of some of the originals that you know, Grace and Frankie on Netflix, that are kind of really attractive originals. But I feel like it's interesting that we kind of come to this kind of indoors moment of our lives, as maybe we had assessed the market to say that Foxtel was really in trouble as a business. Maybe now there's a persuasive case for people to keep it in that way, because we are hungry for content. We are going to be hanging on to a lot of these things to watch. So it's a tricky game, but if I had to pick one, I would probably say Foxtel, as I very quickly closed the door behind me.
Now, look, I agree. I was thinking about this too. I think Foxtel, in terms of prestige dramas, just purely because we're still churning through Succession at home, so I do want to finish that. Mm. But the other, you know, I don't mind Amazon Prime. I'm probably only watching a few things on it, but as soon as Fleabag was announced, that was the whole reason I signed up to Amazon Prime. And, you know, and since then I've enjoyed, you know, Marvelous Mrs. Maisel on it and things like that. So I know, and I'm with you, Paul. I think SBS On Demand is great, but I'm also spending a lot of time watching ABC iView. You know, there's so much still good local stuff, and I quite enjoy their library. That's fine. If I want to watch old episodes of Utopia, it's there. Or catch up with Rosehaven, it's there. That's okay. Look, let's jump ahead now into the back catalogue. I think this is probably something everyone's doing a little bit of at the moment, which is rummaging through the back of the DVD drawer, if they've still got a DVD at home that's working. Today we're continuing our sporting documentary theme as we rummage through the back of the DVD drawer and dig out the games. It is, of course, the classic satirical mockumentary about the organising of the 2000 Sydney Olympics from the brilliant mind of the late, great John Clark, who starred in it alongside his longtime creative partner, Brian Dawe, plus a pre-Kath and Kim Gina Riley. It ran for two seasons from 1998 to 2000, and you can now stream it on the ABC's iView. With this year's Tokyo Games probably being postponed due to the coronavirus pandemic, this may be the closest we get to an Olympics in a while. Michael, is this the kind of unvarnished documentary the Australian cricket team should have had?
Maybe it is. Look, I mean, this is, let's be honest here, the Games is, I've always believed, it's always been at the top of my list whenever this question's been asked. It might be the best comedy in Australian history. And I know that's a really bold thing to say, but gosh, it's really hard. Other than a couple of things that spring to mind, like Kath and Kim or Frontline, or there's obviously a jumble of shows at the top, but the Games is so good. It was so sharp. It was so on point. It spoke to its moment in time. It spoke to a bureaucratic truth that was not just a bureaucratic truth about the organisation of an Olympics, but of any corporation. I mean, it was just, everything about it was a delight. It was just dark and joyous, and we see its small notes in every, you know, government inquiry, every major event organization that has come since it. It's just, gosh, it's, I mean, unless someone can throw me a persuasive case for something else, I would happily declare it the best comedy in Australian history.
All right, well, so just Paul, before we get to you, let's listen to a clip when John Clark is discussing a running track that's about 100 metres.
The 400 metres track is exactly 400 metres long, is it?
That's right.
So the 200 metres track is exactly 200 metres long?
Yes, of course.
But what you're telling me is that the 100 metres track is about 100 metres long?
Slightly different arrangement to the 100 metres track.
Is a metre a slightly different concept, is it, in 100 metres as against 200? Well, I don't understand, Mr. Wilson, quite why in the construction of a 100 metres track you would want to depart too radically from the constraints laid down for us by the conventional calibration of distance.
Paul is chuckling. I can see Paul on my screen here, and he's
so
chuckling
good.
Away.
So good.
I love his almost, you know, his Rumpole-like, you know, inquisition over the... I mean, that episode, that particular moment, it's up there with a Kath and Kim moment. I mean, you know, name your iconic moment of Australian comedy, the 99, the 100 metre track that is only 99 metres.
Oh my gosh.
And then the rationale for how it got that way, how to solve it. It is absolutely brilliant. I mean, you know, you sit there over the last, I don't know how many, 4 or 5 years, I don't know how many millions of dollars has been spent on market research surveys showing that the Australian public has lost faith in bureaucrats and in official organisations. It's like, save your money. I mean, all you had to do was go back 20, 25 years to the Games and, you know, it was prescient in that respect. I mean, it totally nailed that you know, that moment where people, yeah, questioned those, you know, authority figures and in a way, I think it also triggered a whole lot of other shows in its wake.
Well, The Office, well, the UK Office came after
this, office,
didn't it?
The Office, yeah. Utopia is certainly, Hollow Men. One of the things I love about the show too is the way that it completely does away. I mean, up until then, I mean, there's that whole thing of comedians and comedy shows where people had to dress silly, you know, they had to kind of put on a wig to kind of signal that they were slightly, you know, comical characters. I mean, it just completely did away with that. I mean, there's no wigs, there's no, you know, there's none of that kind of artifice of, you know, having to signal, you know. I mean, they were these clownish figures because of what they said, because of what they did, you know. And I love the way that it just completely did away with all of those, those conventions of, you know, a staged comedy.
Yeah. I mean, Michael, do you think, obviously you do, but, you know, it's held up incredibly well over the 20 plus years since it first screened, hasn't it? Still, the humour is still very, very relevant and sharp.
You know, it has. I mean, it's an incredible show. And as Paul says, you know, it's given its due by the slew of imitators, the fact that it is kind of, I mean, workplace comedies have kind of always existed, but it was a very particular kind of workplace comedy in tone that I think, I mean, you know, we don't realistically imagine that the makers of Veep looked at it and aped it, or even that Ricky Gervais saw it and duplicated it. But the truth is, it sort of does comically inform what came after it. It does comically inform the British Office. There's a stack of, you know, sort of in a way, the kind of the proof of the recipe is in the extent to which the meal has been recreated around the world. Not sort of directly, but the fact is, it struck a certain tone that was just exquisite. And still joyful in other shows.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate it. I just love seeing Barry Cassidy in episode one, rolling into a help them out with their press conference with Barry, with his little grey koala bits on the side, but just the brown hair in the middle. He's still very handsome from 20 years ago. He still looked very identifiable as the Barry Cassidy we know and love today. What do you think's happened to Australian comedies, I suppose, now? Is there anything that even comes close to the games? Is something that we've made recently?
It's hard to kind of get into that, because, I mean, Australian comedy particularly is kind of so shaped by the kind of the ebb and flow of funding and kind of creative vision. I think the ABC in the last sort of decade has kind of breathed a lot of life into Australian comedy. There's a lot of very, very sharp comedies, I think, have landed there. And, you know, something like a sketch comedy, like Black Comedy, I think if we had to kind of cut history off the stage and just kind of go, really, what's the best comedy you've seen in the last handful of years? You know, there's, you know, I feel like the sort of the Get Kraken and the black comedy, there's a bunch of shows that have come out of the ABC that I just think are staggeringly funny, just staggeringly brilliant, very dark, very contemporary, very sharp. So I think we still do make those things. I think we've learned a bit of a script around comedy's hard to develop, comedies aren't that funny, you know, the funniest comedies of all time are funny, but everything that came later is really terrible. There's a sort of, we've got a bit of a script around that, which I think we sort of too often stick to. And actually, you know, there's, I think, magnificently funny things are made all the time. Please Like Me is a masterpiece. Everything's Going to Be Okay, which is the sort of sequel of a sort to that, the American show that Josh Thomas has made, is also a masterpiece. I think we've actually made, we make magnificent comedies all the time. I just think we struggle somehow to break out of the narrative that Australian comedies, you know, there's a bit of that that comes with it that I think we have to fight against to give it its kind of its objective air.
Yeah. Okay. Let's have a look at what we're watching as we head into the home straight. Paul, what are you watching in self-isolation this week?
Well, I mean, a bit like what Michael was saying before, watching lots and lots of first episodes of things. Look, one show that I have been, I've stuck with from the very, very beginning and I'm now up to date with is Better Call Saul, which is the prequel to Breaking Bad. This is set in the years before Breaking Bad, and it's really the backstory of Jimmy McGill, who changes his name to Saul. And in fact, in the current season that's on, this is at the moment where he really does turn that corner from being a kind of idealistic but deluded lawyer to being a complete, just deciding that the future was in catering to lowlifes. And what you've also got at this point in the narrative is a lot of the characters who made big appearances in Breaking Bad, we're now seeing, their backstories played out as well. It's a great, I really, really love the show. I think it's got a very, very sly wit, some great performances in it. And, it's one of those great, you know, strange thrillers that delves into this kind of drug subculture of America.
Mm. Okay. Michael, what's in your bag of tricks this week?
Well, I think like all of us, we have like, I depend on a private army of people who recommend shows all the time. And I'm actually just started watching a show which I got, it's that thing where four people mention it to you in the space of 3 days and you just think, oh my God, I think this show's about to pop. It's called Tiger King, Murder, Mayhem and Madness. It's on Netflix. It's about a guy called Joe Exotic. So it's a documentary series about a guy called Joe Exotic, who is a gay gun-toting redneck who owns a big cat park. And by big cat park, I mean he owns like 200 plus African cats, pumas, leopards.
So only in America, surely.
And he is his arch nemesis is this woman called Carol Baskin, who runs an organization in Florida called Big Cat Rescue, which is their stated mission is to stop people like Joe Exotic doing what they do. And it's about the conflict between them. And I mean, it's incredible. There's a, you know, the accusation is that it's all played out in American courts, but he's accused of hiring someone to kill her. And I mean, it's just this thing. So I've only watched the first episode. I'm committed now. It's insane. It's almost too hard to describe in detail, but it's just so crazy bonkers. It's just really, it's incredible. It's kind of one of those things it's a little, it reminded me of the Fyre Festival documentaries in that you spend most of it looking incredulously at your own television, almost in disbelief that you're actually seeing what you're seeing, because it just doesn't seem like anybody could have made this shit up, and that there it is happening in front of you in documentary, in living colour, in real life. It's mind-bending. It's on Netflix.
That sounds like the perfect thing to watch when the end of the world is coming. Look, for me, just like every other parent and probably child under five, last week we were highly anticipating the premiere of season 2 of Bluey. It was fantastic. We've watched, I think there's about 6 episodes already on ABC iView. You can either watch one a day when they drop at, I think, 8 o'clock in the morning, or you can, you know, speed up a bit on ABC iView. And it is great. My daughter is already quoting from it, which is slightly worrying, but I think it's just so funny and so real. And what I love about it, compared to a lot of kids' shows, to say like Peppa Pig, where it's such an English look at the world. You know, there was one episode for Bluey, this one's called Hammer Barn. Within a minute, it's about when they go to Bunnings. Within a minute of it starting, Edie just went, "Ooh, there are Buntings." I was like, there we go, kiddo. So they had the sausages in their hands. They knew exactly what they were doing. So I think it's just tapped into kids, parents, and also I was talking to friends, adult friends on Saturday night too, and they had started watching it independently of their child, which I think is a real tick of recommendation there. So anyway, Bluey for me, love it. All right, guys, let's go back to the quiz, shall we? Okay, so back to Who Am I? Here's part 2 of your hints. You ready? At 7 years old, I got my first acting credit on the TV show Spy Force. I had one line of dialogue opposite the series lead, Jack Thompson. 15 years later, I scored a minor role playing Kenny Larkin, an ex-convict friend of Henry Ramsay, in a long-running Australian soap set in the fictional suburb of Erinsborough. I scored my first leading role at 25 on a film called The Crossing. It was on this set.
Oh, I know. Is it Russell Crowe?
Yes, it is.
It is Russell Crowe. Kenny Larkin. Who can forget dear old Kenny Larkin from Neighbours? I mean, goodness me.
Michael, congratulations. That's 2 for 2.
Oh, gosh. Oh,
well done.
Last week he got 6 degrees of Ben Mendelsohn. This week it's Who Am I? You cannot complain about playing these games, my friend. You love it.
I apologise to Jocelyn Crowe for not guessing it immediately. I should say.
Oh, okay. All right, guys, let's wrap it up. Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Paul. Enjoy your working from home / binging.
Yes.
And hopefully we'll talk to you soon. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Thanks, Lois.
See you later. If you like the podcast, you can find us on iTunes or your favourite podcasting app, and don't forget to subscribe. You can follow Michael on Twitter at Michael Odato, Paul is at Paul_Kalina, and I'm at Lou_Roog. You can also read stories by us on the mastheads of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. We'll catch up with you next time on The Televisionaries. The Televisionaries is brought to you by the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. It's hosted by myself, Louise Rugendyke. It was created and executively produced by Life editor Monique Farmer and Culture editor Matt Burgess. The podcast is produced by Lap Fan, and our head of audio is Tom McKendrick.